Due to technical errors during the recording process, the following program is only partially recorded. The last 25 minutes are missing. However, we present the first 35 minutes of the program here. Good evening and welcome to Bird Calls from the Knoll Foundation Studios here at Red River Radio. Tonight's program is made possible by the Knoll Foundation, the Community Foundation of North Louisiana, and Red River Radio's listeners. Wally Derleth and Sheila Lawrence are at the phones tonight, and we ask that when you call in tonight, please be patient, as we only have the two of them, and they may from time to time have their hands full. We invite you to call in with your questions about our feathered friends tonight and the avian world at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. Cliff Shackelford is our resident ornithologist here at Red River Radio, and he is ready to answer your questions about birds tonight. Cliff is currently the statewide ornithologist for the Texas Parks and Wildlife Department, a position he has had since 1997, and he has been an avid bird watcher for more than 30 years. He is also the first author of the book Hummingbirds of Texas, published in 2005 by Texas A&M Press, and he has authored more than 80 publications on birds and birding. He and his wife Julie and their two children live in East Texas. Cliff, thanks for coming back up.
Hey, Bill. Happy to be here.
Well, let's get you on there. There we go.
All right. Happy to be here, Bill.
Yeah, indeed. So it's a beautiful day out there. I'm wondering, are the birds loving it?
Yeah. I mean, it's finally dry for a moment. It's been such a wet last 8 or 10 weeks in much of the region. It's good to get rain, but gosh, in April, I determined in April and May, we got 40% of our annual rainfall in about a 6 or 8 week period.
Well,
so,
you know, it could be worse. You could be out west with the drought, everything catching on fire. So
absolutely.
It either rains or dries.
I think too much rain is better than none at all, for sure.
Absolutely. So each month, Cliff, we go through at the end of the show a conservation tip, and you usually recap that at the beginning of the show. So refresh our memories about the last month's conservation tip.
Yeah, we had talked about taking a child to a nature center, refuge, or park in search of nature. And by park, I didn't mean a playscape, city park. I was talking about a state park with a lot of nature, a lot of trails, a lot of wild places for kids to explore, especially getting off trail if possible. Unstructured play and exploring is really good for kids, but if you're tired of seeing your kids glued to their electronic devices, do them a favor and take them to one of these places. There's going to be one near you, or make it part of the trip that you're going to take this summer, where they go to a nature center, a refuge, or a park, so they can see nature in its glory, look at birds, take them fishing, just get them outside. There's a book that's been out since 2005 by Richard Louv. It's a must-read on this topic. It's called Last Child in the Woods, Saving Our Children from Nature Deficit Disorder. And I think the key is definitely just to introduce kids to the nature around them, make them realize they're not alone, make them sure that they realize that they're just one small, tiny component on this planet. There's a lot of neighbors, not just human neighbors, but wildlife neighbors that they need to be aware of. Because most kids can't identify 10 species of plants and animals in their yard. They can identify way more than 10 signs up on the roadway, the golden arches and those kinds of signs. But they can't identify the birds and the plants around them. And it's important to know what these things are. For example, poisonous plants. It's good to know what's poison ivy and what's not. Venomous snakes. It's good to know which one's venomous and which is not. Notice that I did not use the word poisonous on snakes. So if you ever say poisonous snakes, it's not correct. It's venomous snakes. So it's good to know what birds are singing around them. That can make a difference. And certainly when calling in this radio show, it's good to know what you're talking about. So take a kid out in nature, do some exploring. Do it a couple times a year minimum, and hopefully, if your kids love it, do it more than that. But get them interested in nature. We need more kids outside.
Yeah, I thought of an incentive way. You could create scavenger hunts, starting with the base plants. Like, you want to know what poison ivy is and poison oak and other things that you want to stay away from, and then you can move on and maybe, you know, put some kind of reward at the end of it.
Yep, scavenger hunt is a great idea.
You are listening to Bird Calls with your resident host, Cliff Shackelford, and he is our ornithologist here at Red River Radio. The number to call tonight is 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. Also, if you have any photos that you would like Cliff to identify, you can send them to me at W Beckett. That's W-B-E-C-K-E-T-T at lsus.edu. We won't be able to get to them tonight necessarily, but they will be on next month's show. So we have a caller online already, Cliff, so I'm going to go to this caller first, and then we will get to our profile species.
Okay.
All right. We are going to Ryan from Alexandria. Ryan, what's your question tonight?
Hey, good evening. I have a mystery bird that has appeared in my backyard in the Alexandria Garden District area.
Okay.
I thought maybe it was a kiwi. There's no way, right?
There's absolutely no way, unless your garden district is in New Zealand.
Okay, well, it looks like a kiwi, okay? It's got like a, it's a plump bird.
Uh-huh.
It's very short. I've never seen it fly. It has sort of, the legs are sort of like an egret.
Uh-huh.
It has a little tuft on its head. It's brown in color and about the size of a chicken. And if I may anthropomorphize it, it looks a little sad.
Sad in what way? Why would a bird be sad?
It looks forlorn. It doesn't seem like it's in its correct environment.
Ah, okay. Well, geez, at first when you mentioned kiwi, I immediately thought of a woodcock, American woodcock. But then when you start describing it, that wasn't what I was thinking of at all. Because a woodcock is about the size of a softball.
No, this is bigger, way bigger. It's like a chicken.
Right, and so you started describing something very different. And I'm wondering, you mentioned a tuft on the head and long legs. He's walking around the ground?
He's walking around on the ground. I've never seen him fly.
Okay. I'm wondering if it's a immature yellow-crowned night heron. Those are seen a lot this time of the year. And they're brown, and they walk around, and they just kind of look very curious, like, what am I doing here, and why are you looking at me?
That's exactly his expression.
Yeah, so write that name down, Ryan, yellow-crowned night heron, and Google that when you hang up, and look up immature. So add the word immature to yellow-crowned night heron, and see if that's what you saw. And look through several pictures, because an immature bird can change during its immaturity. It can, you know, it can be fresh out of the nest or almost ready to get adult plumage. So it's kind of like a baby that, you know, an 8-month-old is very different from an 18-month-old human baby. So that's what my guess is. So why don't you look that up, and maybe if you can sneak back in, we can talk later tonight, Ryan. How about that?
Oh, okay. I'm seeing a picture, and that's what it is. That's definitely what it is. The legs are the same and the beak is the same, although mine is a little plumper than the picture that we saw.
You're able to look it up as we speak in real time. I like it. So
I have I'm outside the car and I'm looking through the windshield at the picture.
And you're talking on the same phone that you just Googled with?
No, separate phone.
Oh, okay.
No, I have an assistant.
Oh, because it's remarkable that we can do this, isn't it? I love it. So, yeah.
You used to have to go to a library and search all through the index to find out what you wanted.
Yeah.
Now, do you think that this bird, the nest is in the trees in the neighborhood, or did it come from somewhere else?
I suspect the nest is within walking distance of that bird.
Wow, that's amazing.
Yeah, and they nest in, you know, fairly tall, bushy trees. They nest sometimes solitarily, sometimes in small groups of a few nests, but they don't nest in huge numbers like a lot of rookeries or heronries with cattle egrets and great egrets and little blue herons and so forth. The yellow-crowned night heron is pretty exclusive. It doesn't like to nest in those big rookeries, so they kind of do solitary nesting. So I imagine it's in a tree within walking distance, within shouting distance maybe. How about that?
Fascinating. I can't wait to research more and learn more about this
bird.
I've never seen one before.
Yeah, very cool, Ryan. Thanks so much for the call.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
And here I thought it might have been a chicken with fabulous style.
You know?
I mean, you know.
Yeah. So. No, I liked his description. He started off with a kiwi that kind of gave me a ballpark, but then when he started going into detail, it changed. It morphed into something very different.
Right.
And then we get a lot of calls. That's another thing that's good about having gray hair. You have a larger sample size of these questions.
Right.
And so not just with the radio show, but with my position of nearly 25 years at Parks and Wildlife, the phone rings, the emails come through, and now with the digital ability to take digital photographs and Facebook, people send pictures. And it's remarkable. I would say that yellow-crowned night heron is easily in the top 10 of what is this bird. I've saw it and I don't know what it is. And it's the adult and the immatures, like what Ryan was talking about. They're just very approachable. They're in urban settings, and so it makes sense that they, you know, and they're large. So they just stand there, because try to do the same with a tiny little songbird up in the 80 foot up in the tree. I don't hear about those, because that's really tough for people to track down and nail a picture.
Very tough.
Yep, but a yellow-crowned night heron is a slam dunk. So cool for Ryan for helping us figure that out.
And you are listening to Bird Calls with Cliff Shackelford, our resident ornithologist here at Red River Radio. John from Fishville, please hang on the line. We do want to get to our profile species this month. So, Cliff, what do you have?
Yeah, tonight we're profiling a small shorebird called sanderling that's found along most stretches of coastal beaches around the U.S. during the non-breeding season. Let's listen to a sanderling here. While visiting most saltwater beaches, this is the small shorebird that runs hurriedly back and forth with the surf. This bird, which usually feeds in small flocks, hunches forward and runs on fast legs as if it's a wind-up toy. When the wave goes out, sanderlings quickly glean the wet sand for tiny invertebrates to feast on, yet must run back to dry sand before the next wave splashes on the beach again. The churning wave action is constantly moving and exposing tiny invertebrate food items consumed by this shorebird. This species has black legs and a thin, straight black bill that's of short length when compared to other shorebirds. Sanderlings are a pale, ghostly white and gray coloration over half of the year, especially during the colder months. In late spring, they undergo a molt that transforms much of their plumage into a rich, rusty brown plumage. Sanderlings migrate far to our north to their breeding grounds in the high Arctic north of Hudson Bay. To see a photograph of a sanderling in winter plumage snapped by James Childress, please visit the Bird Calls page at redriverradio.org.
And indeed, we had one of those sent in, I believe it was last month, from North Carolina. Somebody actually caught one resting. He was just in a chill moment, and somebody got a photograph of
there. Good memory.
You are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford. You can give us a call now, 800-552-8502, 800-552-8502. And John from Fishville, you are on with Cliff. What's your question?
Hey, Cliff, I want to thank you for advising that book you just mentioned, The Last Child in the Woods.
Uh-huh.
I ordered that, and I got it, and I mean, that is an impressive, that's scary information about our children in this nation.
Yeah, it is, and it's, you know, you could link a lot of problems with depression and overeating and so many other problems we have with just not getting out in nature where we can relax and unwind and fresh air and just, you know, learning so much about things around us is part of growing up. I think that's one thing we've really lost. If you look at what Native Americans were doing. They read signs in nature. They knew when cold fronts were coming, not because they had radar. But they looked at bird migration and here come the geese and so forth. And we are totally detached from that. And so the problem is when we have natural events, we don't know how to deal with it. We don't realize that maybe this is a pattern. Maybe this is supposed to happen. And we freak out. And so I think the kids that are exposed to nature have a head start than the rest of us.
Yeah. So, you know, it's a nationwide thing. The metropolitan area children, they have no clue.
No.
They don't ever have the experience.
Yeah.
Of us country folks. We're so blessed to be out here in the middle of the woods.
That's right. And to think about kids that have never seen the Milky Way or even a handful of stars because they're in a light-polluted city, urban environment where they can't even see the night sky is just amazing to me.
I'll tell you an experience I had. I'll try to make it brief. A few years ago, I was at a resort somewhere, and everyone in the resort were city people from New York City with all their grandchildren. This resort had a little spot below the breakfast area.
Uh-huh.
And these children this little spot had some sod, some grass. These children were down there rolling their face in this grass. They had never seen grass in their life.
Yeah.
Now that's scary.
Yeah, it's amazing. Yep.
That's awful.
right. So, well, that's great that you got that book by Richard Louvre. John, appreciate you calling, and thanks so much.
Keep up the good work.
Okay.
Well.
Thank you, sir.
You are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford, and you can give us a call now at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. In the meantime, we have lots of submissions this month, and we're going to go on. First of all, we had some sad news. As many of you know, we've been following along with an eagle cam that had been up positioned so that it could watch this full life cycle of an eagle, you know, pair, literally mating and dropping the eggs. And one of the eggs did not survive, but the other one survived to fledge. And then, unfortunately, a few weeks ago, the winds from a storm took that tree down. Images of the destruction of that tree are on our website.
Yeah, right, and one of our listener friends, Louise, has been keeping us engrossed in this nest that's in the Shreveport area. And we've talked to her and one of her students. She's a school teacher, and we had her on the air a couple episodes ago with one of her students. The good news is, the bad news is, yes, the tree fell. The good news is the young bird had already fledged. And so these kind of storms can happen when the young is only half grown in February or March or even into April, and it's bad news. But luckily this happened when the young bird was able to fly. And they still use the nest as kind of security or home base, and sometimes the adults still bring them food to the old nest. But that's not going to change with the nest down. The immature bird's still going to be able to get food over, you know, in a neighboring tree. But eagle nest trees have a big sail in them. If you think about it, it's a lot of weight, and it makes the tree very top heavy, and their lifespan is about 4 or 5 years on average. So they're very vulnerable to windstorms because of that big sail, that big nest that catches the wind, that also adds very top-heavy weight to a tree. So a lot of trees tip over, and this one snapped in the wind. So sad to see happen, but thank goodness the youngster got out before this happened. And thanks to Louise for keeping us posted. She even told us that the company that had the Eagle Cam is already starting to look into another site. So they got a lot of really good press over that, and the public sure enjoyed it. I know we did, and I know Louise and her students did. So, yeah, hopefully they can find a new nest. But, you know, this is the period where eagles are not nesting. They'll start re-nesting as soon as it gets pretty cold. So November, December is when it'll be pretty obvious where the nest is going to be. And Eagles can build a new nest. If the tree falls on average 4 or 5 years, and it's been happening for millennia, so be it. Eagles know what to do. They'll build a new nest. So
you are listening to Bird Calls from Red River Radio, and Cliff Shackelford is our resident ornithologist, and we'd like to go to the next photograph. This was sent in by Chuck Olme, and it is a great picture of a
It's a baby eastern screech owl, and of course nestling is the proper word, but everybody knows what I'm talking about when I say baby. It's a nestling eastern screech owl, and what's neat about his picture is all young eastern screech owls are overall gray, and they kind of have a fuzzy Brillo pad look to them, but they come in two color morphs. We've talked about this before, especially when we profiled it. The eastern screech owl comes in a rufous or red morph and also a gray morph. So they all look gray except around the eyes, and Chuck's picture really shows that these have that rusty brown around the eyes. So this one, when he grows up, is going to turn into a red morph eastern screech owl. And they're not interchangeable. They don't just decide, hey, I'm going to go gray today. Yesterday I was red morph. You're one or the other, and you don't get to change your garments, your feathers. So cool picture. Thanks, Chuck, for sending that.
We also had some audio that was sent in by a number of listeners, three different sections here. But first I wanted to ask you about this plan of Lieutenant Governor Billy Nungesser about seeking information about designating new birding sites. I think I sent you that, and I didn't know whether you had heard of anything. I mean, you're in Texas, so you may not have followed this, but birds.
I sent that after you sent it to me. I sent it to our representative at Texas Parks and Wildlife, our nature tourism coordinator, who does this same thing in Texas, looks for new sites to add the birding trail, and then some sites go away. They close up shop. Maybe it's a private site. Maybe it's a park that's no longer available. So they come and they go. And so birding trails have to be revised on a every few year basis. So So with Louisiana, they're looking for a call for potential new birding trail sites. And so birding trail sites they're driving trails. So this is not like the hiking the Appalachian Trail. These are merely hot spots where people can drive up and get out and see certain birds or see lots of birds, and then get back in the car and go to another spot down the road. So when we say trail, it's really a driving trail, and these are different stops along the route that are worth visiting for whatever reason of birds. And in Texas, we've expanded it. We call them now our wildlife trails because we include things like prairie dog towns, which you don't have in Louisiana. You got to go west to see a prairie dog town, but they're really cool. And it's really neat to see prairie dogs doing their thing. And there's several birds associated with prairie dog towns, like burrowing owls, and maybe ferruginous hawk, sometimes golden eagle, sometimes mountain plover. There's a lot of other birds associated with them. We also have bat emergence caves in the hill country, where we have limestone karst topography, and in that karst geology, you have these caves that Mexican free-tailed bats use, and they come out in the tens of thousands. Those are on the trail. Butterfly spots are also on the trail. So not just birds. So it's really cool, and it gets back to what we talked about as our refresher. Of what to do, a conservation tip of get kids out in nature. Find out where your birding trail is near you, or if you're traveling somewhere, maybe there's a birding trail. Most states, if not all states, now have birding trails. They started in the with Texas in the mid-90s, about 95 or 96. The trail got finished, first trail in Texas, and all of a sudden, the rest of the states say, hey, that's a great idea, and now they're nationwide. So it shouldn't be hard to find a burning trail near you.
Great ideas are contagious.
Yeah.
You are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford. And you can give us a call now at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. And we go now to Teresa, who is calling in. And what's your question tonight, Teresa? Hello, Teresa? Can you turn your radio down in the back?
Oh, I'm sorry.
Yeah, it comes through as an echo because there's a delay in our system.
Right. Okay, excuse me. My question is, we have hawks. I live in East Texas and between Gladewater and Longview. And we see hawks almost every day, you know, looking for something to eat, sailing around. And the reason, and actually a hawk had a kill in our backyard and we got to watch him devour it. But I was curious because I feed my birds a mixture that has black holes and bark, so I had big sunflowers that have come up on
I'm losing you, Teresa.
We're having trouble hearing you. Please get up closer to the phone.
Yeah, I lost you after you said you had a backyard kill, a hawk kill. So go back there.
Okay. All right, hang on. Can you hear me better now?
Yes.
Oh, yeah.
I had you on speakerphone.
Yucky.
I was curious because I know what the way the hawk seems to take their kill, and it's a little circular area where they eat. That they last week something took off this huge sunflower blossom that I have in my backyard. They come up from the black oil sunflower seeds that I feed them, and I mean, it just ripped. I didn't see it, but I think a hawk did it. Because you could see where they ripped it, and there was a few petals on the ground, and then over farther away, there was a circular area where the sunflower blossom had been demolished. A squirrel didn't do that, okay? Do birds go after sunflower blossoms?
No.
I mean, I know they like the seeds, but...
No, nobody's going to come after the whole head. Are we talking about the size of a small platter? Is it a giant sunflower had gotten that big?
It was about 5 inches.
Yeah, no, that doesn't sound like a bird at all. The only exception would be if some bird was sitting on there and a hawk grabbed it and accidentally grabbed the whole thing, bird and sunflower head. But this isn't really the time of the year when sunflowers are popping just yet. And moreover, there's not a lot of birds right now in your area that are small and light enough to sit on a sunflower head.
Oh, yeah. No, the birds don't ever perch on it. But it's by my clothesline pole, the old kind that's the T-bar, so the birds sit up there.
Yeah.
So maybe. But it was so strange that something took that sunflower blossom a few yards away and tore it all up. And I mean, but there was no drag path.
No.
Like something flew it.
I don't know where you live, but I would think an 8-year-old kid could have done that.
Well, no, except they can't get in my backyard.
Okay.
Well,
don't underestimate 8-year-old boys.
Yeah, I mean,
we could get in anywhere.
Yeah, no, I've had two of them.
Kids love to pluck flowers and take them to mama, and then they realize, oops, this is going to be this. We're stealing. I don't know, but I would not sniff at a bird doing this. That's not where I would point.
Well, we have a lot of squirrels. Do you think a squirrel did it?
I don't know. I mean, I don't think a squirrel can. I mean, it could shimmy up a. If it shimmied up the stalk, it would bend over and probably break.
Right.
But if the stalk's in good shape, I don't think a squirrel did it either. I mean, I don't know what did it, and we'll never know.
I don't know whether sunflowers.
Yeah, I think we're gonna just have to let this one go. If you don't have a game camera up and you weren't looking out the window, we just gotta let it go. Yeah.
Okay. Another question I have: we've had so many birds that migrated through here that stayed here this year that weren't usually here, you know, in the winter time. And there's some bird, and the call is a descending call. And they'll do it two or three times in a row. They'll repeat it. And it could just be a mockingbird. But I never can see the bird. It's always up in a tree.
Yeah.
And now I don't hear it anymore.
Mm-mm.
But the sound is like, you know, it descends like that.
Yeah.
And it does it over and over again. Cause is that any particular kind of bird?
I couldn't hear you.
Well, let me sing it.
Okay.
It just goes down the scale.
Huh.
And then it does it, and I never can see
in
the bird.
In the Gladewater area. Yeah, I don't know. So what we tell people to do is get their cell phone and try to
record it.
And then call us back with that in a future episode.
Well, actually, you can send it in to us, and I can give you my email, I will give it out at the end of the show.
Okay,
yeah.
And I could try it. There are websites that have bird calls on them, too. So maybe if I go through there, I might discover it.
You could go through 550 species. That's a really tough way to do it. Where do you start? The problem. So here's another option, and I'm glad you brought this up because I wanted to mention that the Merlin app by the Cornell Lab of Ornithology, which is an app I've recommended numerous times on the show, has gotten better. They have now a feature called Bird Sound ID or Song ID, where with a click of a button, you point your cell phone, your smartphone, it listens to it. It goes through kajillion recordings at the Macaulay Library of Sound at the Cornell Lab, and it will figure out what is singing, and it's right. Not all the time, or if it's real far away, it might not pick it up. But it's an option for you where you might not need us, Teresa. So if you've got a smartphone or your kids or grandkids have a smartphone, download that free app called Merlin, M-E-R-L-I-N.
Mm-hmm.
And then,
it's been around for a while.
It's been around, but only in the last month has the sound ID feature been added. So they really upped their game with this, and it's a game changer. It is really pretty darn cool, super helpful, and I think anyone listening to this radio station should get on their app store and find the Merlin app. It's free. Download it and play with it. You can start figuring out with the help of that app what's calling in your backyard.
Now, is this a new app? Because I have the Merlin on, but I've had it on for, I think, better than a year.
Yeah, you just need to make sure it's updated.
Okay,
so you need to update it.
I didn't know whether I needed a new one or I needed to do some kind of update on that, because that will help.
Yeah, and you might have auto updates. Or like me, it tells you, hey, you need to update 16 of your apps or 10 of your apps, and it'll do it. And so it's a game changer.
Yeah.
And that should really...
That's wonderful information.
Yeah,
because I've heard so many different birds this year that I've never heard before. So.
Yeah, so that app will really help now. And so hopefully it doesn't put me out of business. That's what I'm worried about. How about that?
Oh, no. You know a lot more besides what they sound like.
Well, yeah. So, and they still have some wrinkles. My wife and I just got back from North Dakota. People have asked us, why'd you go to North Dakota? And it's true. Sadly, it comes up as like the 50th place to visit out of all 50 states, but not if you're a bird watcher. Because a lot of the birds that winter in Texas or maybe pass through Texas breed in North Dakota. So we went up there to look at a lot of our birds that we don't hear singing or might be in a drab winter plumage. We got to see them in all their full glory and song up in North Dakota. We tested the app up there, and a couple times it picked up stuff that we weren't hearing. And once we saw the app said, oh, there's a willow flycatcher calling, I was like, holy crap, there it is calling in there. So it was pretty neat, but there are wrinkles because it was one stop. It was pulling up three species that don't occur within four states of North Dakota, like yellow-eyed junco, black-chinned sparrow, and canyon towhee at one stop in the Badlands. That they still got to get that wrinkle out of there, but it's still a very cool feature, and I highly recommend it. Yeah. So thanks for the call, Teresa. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Yep.
You are listening to Bird Calls with your resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford, and you can give us a call now as we have lines open at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. Maybe those three species were actually tourists too, like you.
And they
may have come in just for you.
And that's true. I mean, there's hundreds and hundreds of examples of birds that are vagrants that are off track and out of place. And that's the way to find them. But yeah, we couldn't find in those three species at all. And I think they were in error.
Now, if it was a kiwi, it would really be off
track.
Kiwi
would probably be, that would be pretty amazing.
All right. And we're going to go next to our phone lines. Daniel is here. And Daniel, what's your question for Cliff?
Hey, can you hear me?
Yes, we can.
Yeah, where are you calling from, Daniel?
Shreveport. Thanks so much for taking my call.
Yeah.
I just got a real quick question. How rare are woodpeckers? Because I've seen two in the past 2.5 years in Shreveport.
They are not rare at all. And you've got probably seven species of woodpeckers possible in Shreveport.
I'm so sorry to interrupt you. I meant roadrunners. In my head, I'm nervous. I can't believe y'all took my call. I meant roadrunners. I haven't seen one for a very long time. How rare are roadrunners?
They're not super rare. They're uncommon and spotty. And they definitely weren't here, I would say, 150 years ago. There were no roadrunners. We've opened up the forests. We've allowed them to move from their more western occurrence into the piney woods. If you were here 150 years ago, you wouldn't have seen one. But now they have kind of walked their way over here. And
that is
unusual.
I thought they were more rare than that. They're
still very spotty. So where I live in East Texas, and I drive around a lot for work and for pleasure, and I'll see I'll probably see five or six a year while driving around within a 50-mile radius of home, and I'll make note of where they are because they're noteworthy, but they're not unheard of. So
I'm not crazy.
Yeah.
We apologize, but the last 25 minutes of this show were lost during the saving process due to a computer crash.